Blog Talk Radio.
About co-creating our universe, if you will.
And but, and I say co-creating because we're creating with the Creator. We've been given that unique ability to create our realities. We are created. We embody this physical vehicle, this body, and we do the best we can with it. Some are it's very difficult to understand how we can become so very the idea that all men are created equal may, you know, is kind of not so true. Not physically, anyway. That we're all created differently with different DNA structures and different weaknesses and strengths. And, you know, some people are extremely agile and athletic and can run marathons and win gold medals and the Olympics, where others like myself are not quite as athletic or coordinated as any of those people. Nor are we driven in those directions to excel physically. You know, it's very difficult to do that. It takes a lot of willpower. And but I believe that everybody everybody inherently has the as God within them, you know. But what we do with that, we can diminish that, or even black it completely out, or we can grasp that thought and listen to our hearts, listen to our intuition. And follow it to where it's supposed to lead us. And God, we, you know, one, me being one who's been led all over the place, it wasn't until quite a number of years ago that I discovered what my what drove me, you know, or what I felt I could, what I should do, you know, in life, even though I had done a number of things and been in businesses. And, but I, you know, I was never happy until I discovered this medium and the other television and so on. But also to find a way to express these thoughts, you know, and to present these concepts, you know, to people in some form or another, or to express my political concerns or my, overall emphasis. As a political activist, which I believe I was, and I guess I still am to a large degree, but I found myself, after I wrote my book, and after I the election of Obama, and, you know, and the 2010 elections and so on, I really, really, really was disgusted with politics. I got to the point where nothing was worth dealing with politics anymore, and devoted my attentions toward bringing out more truth and environmental issues and health issues and philosophical issues, and trying to identify the spirit. And George was a big help in that. You know, he guided me in directions that I later expanded on or wrote upon or further, did further research on. And this particular essay I want to read tonight is, you know, has much to do with that. These lectures were rather profound. And tonight's lecture is called The Citizens of the Cosmic Commonwealth, Accepting the Leadership of the Divine Will, as by lecture by Manly P. Hall, that he wrote, I believe, in 1972, if I'm not mistaken. 1972. It starts this way. For many thousands of years, human beings have dreamed of an equitable physical social institution. Very long ago, efforts were made to actually create social commonwealths that were suitable to the essential needs of man. But the needs for such commonwealths have changed through the ages. Most of the utopian dreams of the past would not be satisfactory today. They are largely conservative and bound by various religious considerations, and were applicable to societies no longer in existence. Still, however, we are faced by this need for some type of workable government throughout the world that will ensure some type of workable, that will ensure a maximum security for the individual and give to the various members of his social group the rights and privileges of that security. But with these rights are inherent responsibilities we must never forget. The factor that is distinguished in nearly all ancient utopian schemes is that is this requirement for a personal responsibility. Sir Thomas More's utopia was not a blessed land of idleness. Every practical utopia from Tommaso Campanella's City of the Sun to Francis Bacon's New Atlantis included also the Platonopolis of Platonius and J.V. Adrian's Christianopolis were institutions of cooperation and mutual support. We know that the trade unions and guilds that developed in the Middle Ages bestowed benefits upon their members in relationship to the contributions which the members made to the excellence of his community. It was not the payment of dues which it provided preference. It was the outstanding achievement of skill within his own group. We know also that for a very long time, human beings have recognized the importance of developing ways of using natural resources without abusing them. S. Gault's Nova Salima, one of the greatest utopias of the 17th century, emphasized strongly man's cooperation with nature. The isolated hero cycle, which centers around a marooned man such as Robinson Crusoe and his experiences on some island, also contains the philosophy that man must cooperate with nature for the attainment of a better world. Yet man's leadership in nature cannot be taken for granted. The alchemists, the luminists, the Rosicrucians, and numbers of various societies surrounding such concepts as those found in Boccalini's A General Reformation of the World, accepted a leadership in nature with reverence. Humanity has the potential of being nature's administrator, executor, and willing cooperator in the divine plan. It has everything at hand to be this willing cooperator, but yet it has to the present time neglected this awesome privilege and has abused its rights. As a result of this failure to cooperate, man has continued from generation to generation, perpetrating miseries that are not essential. Yet this perpetration will not be interrupted unless the individual accepts his responsibilities as a citizen of nature. Nature gives man many benefits and blessings. Yet in reality, we are more than beholden to nature. We depend upon nature for our very survival. We could not last even for a few seconds without the continuing benevolence of a very skillfully developed and administrated universal system. Yet we have become so accustomed to our privileges that we have taken them for granted and more or less resent our responsibilities. In this, we are much like many young people of the present generation who feel that they are entitled to everything, but must not be required to make any modifications in their own conduct. Citizenship in nature demands understanding of nature, insofar as this is possible. We all know that the ultimate mysteries of life have not yet been generally solved. Only some believe they have all the answers. But there is no general agreement concerning the nature of ultimates. I think it is best to assume that all knowledge available at the present time is relative rather than absolute. Yet science could give us many insights into the operation of universal purpose. But because of the continuing emphasis upon the exploitation of natural resources for human profit, most scientific research today is largely concerned with amplifying man's privileges. This research, of course, cannot give us an understanding of man's responsibilities to nature and nature's reasonable demands upon the individual that cannot be denied or avoided. As the result of this directed attention, science is not aiding us to discover and ground the ground plan of universal purpose. In fact, a very large number of scientists would question the reality of the purpose in nature and would admit that they neither knew or cared whether there was such a purpose. We would like to assume that man is lord over all he surveys and that it is up to him to bind the universe according to his own desires and ambitions. This assumption has been present for a long time, and its continuance has been made possible by the comparative passivity of population. Up to the last 500 years, there has always been vast areas in which pioneering and further expansion of culture have been possible. We probably would have come to our present crisis in the 16th or 17th centuries had it not been for the opening of the Western Hemisphere. Here was a great area sparsely populated and suitable for colonization. We have gradually reached the end of this type of evasion, and we can no longer walk out on... congestion. We can no longer scatter to other areas to distribute more evenly our population. We are faced now with the inevitable problem of getting along with ourselves, and most of all, getting along with nature. We are beginning to realize that nature will not change its ways, and it either is a friend or enemy, depending entirely upon how we use or abuse it. A pattern of responsible conduct is emerging at the present time, and the real facts of life are becoming a source of great uneasiness to polluters and exploiters of natural resources. We have every reason to be worried and concerned about our ecological future. We despair at some obvious facts, but fortunately, nature is not in the business of providing punishment. Its tactics are not Gestapo-like. Nature is benevolent as long as man acts with intelligence. We despair because we realize our selfish and careless past. Nature cannot and will not permit continuous violation of natural law. Finally, our mistakes catch up with us. This is not something that we need face with excessive discouragement or the type of anxiety which can cause a world's neuroses. But it is certainly mandatory that we do some clear thinking, and clear thinking nearly always means unselfish thinking. Most persons are frustrated by the fact that no matter how carefully they think, world conditions remain the same. Actually, few of us are really capable of influencing world conditions, even though we see clearly what requires immediate attention. Nature has always confronted man with this challenge. In the long run, however, nature insists that insists the person who is right and whose actions are coincidental with her purposes. Let me reread that so it makes sense. In the long run, however, nature assists the person who is right and whose actions are coincidental to her purposes. It is therefore better for a person to form a private partnership with integrity than it is to say, I can do nothing because others do nothing. Our private partnership with nature is not something that nature is likely to overlook, and we have proof of this in practically every science relating to the improvement of man's conditions here. Physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual. Even when a person lives in a community which breaks all the rules, he can apply them nevertheless to himself in his own conduct, and consequently, he shall escape many of the ailments which will be common to the others. For there is an inevitable consequence to every action. Every action has its inevitable reaction with a certainty that that night follows day. The fact that your friends and acquaintances are alcoholics does not demand that you be an alcoholic, nor does it mean that if you refuse this giddy euphoria, nature will punish you for being unsociable. For nature recognizes integrity and reaches down to the being, to the smallest living creature, to pat it on the head. Symbolically speaking, when it does a good job, man is not a creature who must make the same mistakes as his group. He theoretically has the intelligence to learn from the mistakes of other human beings, and has the right to be right at any time. This idea that it will never, this idea that it will never been noticed and no one will ever care is foolish, for every phase of our lives reveals that we are noted and what we do is carefully considered.
Divine law,
we need neither a defense nor an accuser. Our own sense of divine law, we need neither a defense nor an accuser, or our own integrities are sufficient. It is a requisite that we implement this type of thinking as soon as possible. We live in a world in which too many resources have been exploited and too many mistakes have been made. Resources that have required millions and, or perhaps billions of years to create are being wantonly wasted in a matter of a few centuries, and many of these materials approach foreseeable depletion. We are gradually impoverishing our relationship with those natural factors which supply our survival. This does not mean we are in imminent danger or that some horrible catastrophe is inevitable. What it means is that each person must gradually think through the problem of value and his own legitimate requirements, and thinking is why we were put here. We were not born just to suffer, but we were not born to do just as we please. Evidently, somewhere in the great plan of things, there is an educational factor, and we are here to be educated. Like most children, we resent education. Without realizing it, at some time long ago, we resented universal law and considered the spiritual government, or whatever the universal hierarchy may be called, as a super establishment. We decided to declare war on it and assert our own authority. And from this assertion of individuality, we have never fully recovered. We want to control and exploit the world at the same time. Gradually, science, or rather our own particular interpretation of science, has destroyed our capacity for veneration and has replaced it with equally peculiar attitudes as to how we can best exploit nature's natural resources forever. Excuse me, I have to just close the door here. We allow this exploitation because we do not recognize any morality other than our own, and therefore we can never be punished for what we do. What we fail to note is that the fact that there may well be a built-in morality. Everything we do has its consequences, and these consequences are honest in terms of what we have done. Here we must begin to think a little differently about the future. We must realize that competition is less attractive than cooperation. It may take us another 50 or 100 years for this to be obvious, but a world of competitive processes, a world in which individuals are constantly seeking advantage over other individuals, must be replaced with a world of individuals who can work together for mutual assistance. This self-assertiveness is going to be very hard for some people to give up, and some individuals go into a virtual panic at the prospect of cooperation. I talked not long ago with a man who admitted that he didn't wish to live so long as to see this happen. The only fun he had in life was getting something away from someone else. Well, if he isn't dead by the time this happens, he won't last long afterwards. But how we have developed this attitude is difficult to understand because we all understand that we live in a universe of limited resources. None of us have a true claim on nature or nature's abundance. They belong finally to the environment in which we exist. They are not ours. We claim that they are ours because we happen to be sitting on them, but after we are gone, another generation will claim them, and 100 generations have claimed them before we arrived, and they and their claims have all gone. Yet the resources remain as far as they survive our own selfishness. The full situation in that our survival depends upon a form of natural supply, which we did not invent, which we did not create, and which we have done nothing to protect. In fact, we have done everything we could to waste this generosity of nature. It is really required of us to intellectually plan the use of natural supply in a sense of fairness with all men. And it is time for us to think clearly for a different kind of life. For if we do not accept it voluntarily, it will nevertheless come about. One of these days, there isn't going to be any more crude oil with which to make gasoline. It just depends on how fast we use it up. One of these days, we might find food in short supply, even in this nation of wealth. And we will discover that a nation cannot continue to dump its pollution into its water and air without the gravest of consequences. But we still can cling to the hope that science will be able to take care of this problem as well. But the difficulty is the trend in science, which we must admit. When science discovers its peculiarly good solution for something, there are usually few survivors. The scientific process creates too many dangers in itself and usually interferes with the balance of nature. This abundance of technology and industry is creating much of the same situation as excessive medication creates in the body, poisoning. You know, and he's talking about genetically modified foods and chemicals and you name it. By treating every ailment, pain, and discomfort with some pill, regardless of their combinational or accumulative effect, we are producing a combustible state that threatens our survival. So all these problems will not be solved by science finding new answers to delay the realization that we cannot misuse with impunity. No matter what science finds, unless man changes, scientific discoveries will move against the good of the individual and against the good of the natural plan of things. So we must begin to think in more nervous terms of building the kind of world our grandchildren, or perhaps our great-grandchildren, will have to live in, a world in which a completely new standard of value is accepted. This necessity will prompt the new Renaissance. This is a motion from the old to the new, and we are trying to push the old into the new, but it does not work. And we are also trying to run away from the present into the vacuum of undone good, and this will not work. We cannot escape into a future unless we have a reasonable, workable plan for that future. If we do, we merely extend the present into the future. But eventually change is inevitable, and it is inevitable that we do face up to our problems. Change is not inherently bad, nor inherently good, but it is the consequence of action. And for the future, we would hope that man shall outgrow a type of life that is no longer suitable. Also to be remembered is the fact that the consciousness of man is in evolution. Behavior that was sustainable, that was suitable 500 years ago, is not now appropriate. Even though it is admitted that examples of man's wide past are still very much with us, but the general trend has been one of improvement, and this improvement is breaking through in a number of areas. We are no longer willing to accept as inevitable the ills of the past. We are no longer willing to accept the adage that things must go on as they have in the past. Not long ago, people were still saying, there has always been war, and there will always be war. There was large numbers of persons today who do not believe that. They may be in the minority, but their numbers are still considerable. And unfortunately, however, we have practical solutions for the avoidance of the resolutions of conflict. And a few of them are fighting their own private wars over nothing more consequential than the privilege of being able to abuse their bodies with marijuana. They may scream over ecological pollution, but think nothing of polluting their brains. But still the concept remains that things can be better, problems can be solved, and we are beginning to realize that the reason why our problems have not been solved is because up to now, problems have been profitable. And as long as they remain so, solutions will not be diligently sought. To face this type of responsibility, the individual must begin to work with himself. Many years ago, the gentleman who preceded me as pastor of the Church of the People here in Los Angeles, Mr. Reynold Light, asked the question, which seems to me to be rather important. How much is a man worth who has lost everything he has? This is actually a very important question and a very simple answer. He is worth nothing more nor nothing less, for worth is not determined by possessions. What a man owns has nothing necessarily to do with what he is worth in terms of essential value. For a man is worth the investment required to build his present character and integrity. A man is worth his creative skills and what he can contribute to the common good of man, and he is worth the noblest of his own convictions. These are his values. And someday these will have to become world values. In every man, every great system of religion, and every great system of philosophy have pointed out these truths to our attention. But no one has yet been strong enough to apply them. The only time they will be applied is when man realizes that to not apply them is more painful than using and cooperating with these inevitables. But perhaps this is not too far from our present thinking. We must now begin to reorient ourselves in the terms of value and be mindful of that of our reason for being here is to become more conscious of universal values, wiser in the use of things for which we have stewardship, and more modest in our demands. We shall depend ever more upon the resources of our internal life for the satisfaction of career and personal development. To create or assist in something of value is the real reward for effort. With all our living, we must keep faith with the laws governing living, not man-made but universal laws. Let us side of all of this also looms clearly on the horizon. Human beings do not enjoy being uncomfortable. We do not want to be permanently miserable. We wish to do whatever we please without consequences. As this formula is proving itself to be unreasonable, it has to be discarded. The goal of man's existence is an inner security, happiness, and enlightenment. The individual is here to grow, and if he grows gracefully, he will be happy. If he grows only through misery, of course, he will be unhappy and will resent the cost of his enlightenment. But in either case, he will grow in understanding. He has the right to grow with the happiness, enjoying his life experiences, and he has the right to be a better person every day because he finds his greatest joy in the surpassing of self. I wish people would be more aware of that. Because it's so true, you know. This is so true. That we can be let me just repeat. He has the right to grow with happiness, enjoying his life's experiences, and he has the right to be a better person every day because he finds his greatest joy in the surpassing of self. We are surrounded with a vast body of evidence which attests to the divine plan of things. It is our privilege to be able to observe this body of natural phenomena and to realize the course we ourselves must take. We must learn to use natural law as the final criterion for value. No one, not even the most skillful of persons, can go against natural law for any substantial length of time. It may appear that we can break natural law temporarily, but the law which we try to break will ultimately break us. We cannot succeed in defying nature. Nature, however, offers a number of benevolent prospects. There is no reason why a human society, from which a number of major defects have been removed, should not enjoy far greater health, length of life, trust, and security for its citizens, and still operate with greater effectiveness. As it participates more in nature's program for health, it shall enjoy greater social health. It is not at all unreasonable to assume that with the length of time required for the individual to achieve maturity, he should not be able to continue for another 100 years. This will remain uncommon, however, as long as most of us are breaking the rules and are living in a society which itself breaks the rules. We can, however, correct this rule-breaking tendency. There is no reason why anyone has to remain a neurotic forever. Neurosis may be one of the greatest causes of misery that we have in the world today, but it is not inevitable, nor a necessity. It is a mental sickness that results almost completely from man's inability to understand the laws of his own mind. Not that he does not know what these laws are, what makes him sick, but his emotions and attitudes will not permit him to transcend his own errors. One of our big problems in this necessity to avoid pain and discomfort. We enjoy a Herculean meal and then medicate ourselves to avoid the discomfort from eating too much. And we do everything possible to ensure mental fatigue and anxiety and then reach into the medicine chest so we can ignore the symptoms of stress. Why do we wonder what we cannot survive successfully on food with no nutritional value? And why must we sacrifice 50,000 Americans in automobile accidents every year, maiming many times that figure? And these are not requirements of nature and the idea that these things are inevitable, because they are part of progress, is just stupid. They are not inevitable, and they are not part of progress. They are the inevitable consequence of man's own stupidity and nothing else. But these things can be corrected. There is no reason why we should have the type of crime that is now besetting us. There is no reason why a university professor with a PhD should invite his students to be users of narcotics. He shares the same stupidity with his students who accept his offer. These things are unnecessary. And I'm sure he's referring to Timothy Leary at that point. Most of the mistakes we make are simply the results of our own immaturity, selfishness, foolishness, and arrogance. Nature does not permit this to confine indefinitely. For if nature did not step in, then the purpose of nature would be damaged. Then we would be in danger of the grand frustration. Nature will keep on pounding on us until we make the necessary corrections. We have also fairly exhausted by international complications. We are tired of boundary lines, and we are tired of the perversities and inconsistencies of various administrations all over the world. We are tired of nations that acquire their freedom only to make their own citizens less free 6 months later. We saw that recently in Egypt. These immaturities, Libya as well as Syria is developing that too. These immaturities, personal nature, national and international, are not required of nature. They are not some mass of inevitables that have descended from the stars, nor are they requirements of some starry influence. They are actually the result of our own unregenerate attitudes. These unregenerate attitudes are leading us to a situation which no one will enjoy. Humanity as a group will rise against these national selfish attitudes, and such solutions are going to be considered for a global perspective, from a global perspective. And the more, and we're talking now about Occupy Wall Street, we're talking now about massive and so on, let's see. And the more enlightened our decisions, the more unselfish our goals, and more likely they will have an impact. For all solutions are relative and either work with the plans of nature and endure or oppose nature and collapse. I think every one of us should allow a certain portion of the state to make peace with life, and this does not ordinarily require more than a few moments each day. We can do it in various ways, and the various meditational systems of the world might assist us. But here, technique is less important than intent. We will find that if this peacemaking does nothing else, it will begin to make life less expensive. When we make peace with life, it's entirely possible that our doctor's bills will be reduced and we will be able to throw away all that junk in the medicine cabinet. I even suspect that we will have fewer lawsuits. And those inevitable sorrows and misfortunes which arise from poor decisions will no longer plague us. Religions in the past have tried to help us make this peace with nature, but unfortunately religions are made up of people. Religion is not a sacrosanct group which is isolated from humanity. It is a conviction interpreted or misinterpreted by millions of people. But basically, religion has given us the Golden Rule and the Ten Commandments, and these basics are verified every day by the conduct of man of goodwill in every land. The Ten Commandments have been more important than any scientific discovery yet made. And without the Ten Commandments, science is capable of creating monsters who turn on their creators. To have skill without having developed integrity is a fatal situation. Plato, Aristotle, Plotinus, Proclus, and Iamblichus were all the great Western philosophers, and Confucius, Lao Tse, and Buddha have testified that selfishness is man's biggest problem. Perhaps Buddha was one of the most outspoken on this problem, for he was so convinced that human selfishness and human ignorance were the foundation of man's dilemma, that he strongly advocated the intelligent person to renounce the entire social and mental structure to which he belonged. There is a slight modification of this view in the later developments of Buddhism, but it is still a renunciation of worldliness, if not a renunciation of the world itself. But one important point remains constant, and that is that our own minds are the tyrants. Until we educate our own minds away from selfishness and ambition, there will be no peace in the world, no peace of mind, and no bliss in the world to come. This is very basic, and the proof of this is the fact that when we start to make these corrections, life becomes more interesting and fulfilling, for we are working with nature and not against nature. Therefore, we are accepting the responsibility of conduct. We can then realize why minds are given to us, that they might be used. We were not intended to use our minds as perpetual instruments of an adolescent playtime. The mind must grow up and become the protector of the individual and not the exploiter of society. If mind stuff is properly trained, it can accomplish great things, but an undisciplined mind complicates, confuses, and causes the individual to be here, there, and everywhere. In the days that lie ahead, one of the two points might be of interest. Man must basically develop a workable faith, a faith that is based not upon creedal affiliations, although this is not necessarily wrong, but a faith that is operative. The individual must gradually come to know that there are powers and forces in nature which are dedicated to good, and if we do not assume them to be good, we still have to assume them to be natural. And whether we accept or dislike natural law, we will obey it or suffer. And experience proves to us that natural law is right, and when we cooperate with it, we perceive its intelligent workings in every part of existence. So we must have a faith. We have to believe sincerely that there is a purpose, and we may not know what that purpose is, but we have to believe in it, and we have to believe that this purpose requires us to be honest. If we are honest, this purpose will protect us, and if we are not honest, this purpose will turn against us and punish us. This much religion we have to have. We have to have a faith in the integrity of the total existence to which we belong, and we have to realize that this total existence demands that we keep that faith every day, all the time. If we do this faith, the future of our life, the future of our way of life is assured. If we do not keep it, the future lies in the uncertain bog of conflict and confusion. After we once have a faith which makes us stronger to do what we know we must do, we can then learn its intellectual justification, but faith nearly always has to have an emotional impact if it is to be effective. And a mental systemization does not have sufficient force behind it to bring change in conduct. The principal support of faith in man, however, is experience. Lord Bacon declares that there were three instruments in his Instauratio Magnus, or the establishment of knowledge. One is tradition, faith supported by the evidence of our ancestors in the past. In this way, faith is strengthened by history and the total adventure of man's existence. The second instrument of knowledge is observation, by which we look about us for the immutable workings of universal principles. If we want to look for these principles, we will find them everywhere. If we choose to ignore them, we can, but to our own delay. But whether we find them, to ignore them, we can. But whether we find them or whether we ignore them, They operate on us, and the fact that we try to ignore them has no effect upon their immediate reaction to our lives. The third instrument is experimentation, in which we can set up various processes by which immutable operations of natural law can be verified and justified. These experiments can fulfill the scientific requirement for repeatability and can be performed again and again to demonstrate the absolute consistency of universal processes. In the laboratory, we find that cause and effect inevitably follow each other. So in various ways within our means, it is possible to become increasingly aware of nature's purpose and nature's omniscience. We can also gradually become more respectful of nature, realizing that this vast environment in which we exist is worthy of veneration. It is worthy of obedience and the recognition of being the natural leader of all that lives. We are all citizens of this natural commonwealth. We do not make its laws, but we must obey them. We can trust these laws, not because they originate in human fallibility, but because they would exist independent of man's recognition. They are supported by the infinite purpose of life, purposes which are not easily disproven, and even when we cannot fully understand them. So natural law becomes the overlord. It is the above everything. It is above nations and the United Nations. All things men build must be built in harmony with these things, or they will not live. And nothing which is built in harmony with the universal law will actually perish. So instead of believing ourselves to be castaways on a little ball in space, which we call the Earth, we are actually involved and surrounded about and permeated throughout our entire structure with a network of immutable principles. Law is the intelligence in the body of space. It sees to it that the will of God is executed, and it is as near to us as our breath. It is something which governs every part of our lives. There is not a function in our body which does not operate under law. There is not a mood or emotion which does not produce its inevitable consequences. And every work of art attests to the intelligence which is impregnated in matter. Machines are men's efforts to duplicate and amplify forces already present in nature. Excuse me. To the sensitive man, there is overwhelming proof of universal law, and this proof is the answer to the lawlessness of men. And someday we shall all face this fact with acceptance. We do not have the right to make rules that are contrary to the purposes of life. Selfishness, indifference, and cruelty can result only in the denigration of society. And I've got only 2 more minutes left to tonight's program, and I'll stop there. This essay continues for another 15, say 9, 6 pages or so. And so this would take at least another half an hour to get through. So I'm going to leave it at that tonight, and I will take it up next week, perhaps if we have time. But I hope it left you with some kind of idea of a natural knowledge, natural law, and the universal law and concepts that I believe, I know exists. I see it when I plant. I see it when I watch the grass grow, and I watch, you know, things grow, and I see it when Lila does her incredible gardening. She's got a beautiful garden, a beautiful yard filled with marvelous things that grow every year. And we, I see it in my dog. I see it in myself. If I live right, if I eat right, if I, don't do things to excess, then I'm healthier, happier. And with that, I've got about 45 seconds. I just wanted to also say, please join me tomorrow night, if you can, when we have a very, very special tribute to George Dixon. We'll have his daughter, Heather, joining us. Peter Moon, hopefully to join us, and Preston Nichols and all of his friends, and some of his listeners and fans. And we hope everybody joins. I guess I can take up to 100 callers on this new Blog Talk studio, so we hope to be able to do that. And in the meantime, I want to thank you for joining me tonight, and I wish you well. And please join us tomorrow night with a tribute to George Dixon.